Welcome to the Executive Function Podcast, where we make the invisible keys to success easy for you to teach your child. We'll go beyond theory to proven action, helping you create peace and independence at home and at school with your host, educational author, award-winning teacher, and celebrated learning coach, Sarah Kesty.
Hey, team. You come to this podcast for executive function tips. And one of the basics for building any sort of brain skills is sleep. And we are so lucky to have Sandman sidekicks and sleep experts, Heather Turgeon and Julie Wright. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, how did the two of you come to be so passionate about sleep?
Well, our passion for sleep came from helping babies and little kids, mainly parents in the first year with sleep, because as you know, when your baby is not sleeping, it feels like a real crisis, but one that parents are often presented with two seemingly polarized, you know, approaches to, like a harsh, cry it out, strict, you know, close the door and don't go in, or an attachment parenting, you know, respond and help and soothe. And we found parents getting so confused between those two options that they felt like they had to choose. And as therapists and sleep specialists, we knew that didn't make any sense. So we came together because we were passionate about baby sleep and helping parents solve this dilemma and sleep through the night in a way that felt really good. And so we love that. And that's our book, The Happy Sleeper. We wrote that book many years ago. And people love it because it's a middle ground approach, a reasonable approach based on science, developmental science. And we love that. We just absolutely love that we help parents sleep through the night because it's life-changing. But what we noticed in our research over the years, because our happy sleepers got older and older, and our practice expanded, and we became more interested in the science of sleep and did a lot of research and really discovered that teenagers are the ones who need our help the most.
Right.
They are the most sleep-deprived population ever in history. So when we saw that, we really felt compelled, like we have to shift our focus for the moment to write this new book. We did, you know, our best to unpack why it is, and we can talk more about that. So in the book, we explore why are teens the most sleep-deprived population in history, and then what are the steps that families can take and schools can take to fix it.
That's awesome. I love it. And you're speaking right to the heart of executive function too, because, you know, like tired brains don't think as well. And if we're asking our teens to just be constantly growing physically, emotionally, mentally, you've got to have those brain vitamins, and sleep is one. And just for listeners, I will link the book in the show notes and everything so you can grab a copy because it is killer awesome. And what I really appreciated about it is kind of what Heather was touching on. There are so many tips, actionable logistic components rather than just kind of staying nebulous, you know, you should do this or a great idea is. It's more like, here's what it actually looks like. Here are some tools to test run, which is what, you know, we provide on the show too. So it meshes perfectly with our mission on the Executive Function Podcast.
That's great.
Speaking of legit usable tools, you were mentioning that you empower parents to help their teenagers. And I can envision a couple of our listeners going, oh, you don't know my kid. Teens are tricky, right? And it's sort of this almost like teenage allergy to, if parents recommend it, they're just allergic to that idea. They're not going to do it. So we know teen brains are naturally developmentally going to push against something that adults suggest. How do we then work within that construct of their developmental space and give our teen beasts the perspective where they actually have buy-in to getting more sleep?
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question, isn't it? So One of the things we always want to start with is this message to parents and also to teenagers that we are absolutely not pointing the finger at them for being responsible for this crisis, nor are they able to solve it on their own. So the starting point is to help families understand the multiple factors we call, you know, that contribute to the perfect storm of why teenagers are so sleep deprived. So those include, you know, a lot of modern day changes in teenagers' lives, including increased homework, increased activities. Teenagers are expected to do more and more activities now in preparation for college admissions, which is just, you know, snowballed over the years. Then we have technology coming in and sort of taking this, you know, later and later bedtime and, of course, pushing it even later. We have the natural teen biology, which pushes sleep later. So sleep is very, very delayed on the bedtime end. And then we have high school start times that are almost universally too early, which squeezes sleep on the morning end. So we have a mathematical impossibility. And if you think about these factors that I just mentioned, parents and teens cannot control most of them, right? So we devoted the second half of the book, you're absolutely right, to what we love, them, you know, what our special sauce is, helping families with sleep. So the whole second half of the book is full of how to talk to your teen, how to get them to be self-motivated, and how to empower them with knowledge. But I think the starting place is helping teenagers know about this perfect storm so that they realize, you know, wow, the world is a little bit stacked against me right here, but I need to really take care of myself, because, you know, big tech and college admissions and high schools are not really looking after me. And, you know, that's just one piece of the puzzle. But the more information and knowledge they have also about how the brain works and why sleep is so important and how it affects things in their individual life that they care so much about, all of those things are sort of your way in, because as you well know, they need to care, they need to want to do it, and they need to want to learn about sleep and how to help. So it's not an easy recipe, but it's one that will enhance your relationship with your teenager, and it's one that will affect their life forever.
Right. Yeah. And you, oh man, you're giving me so many ideas. And what I'm kind of appreciating in terms of just taking this like a backwards perspective of convincing your teen to work on anything is this like dichotomy of depersonalizing it and also really personalizing it. So depersonalizing it in terms of like, hey, this is brain science. This is the man, like big tech trying to get you. This is like, let's concretize it and put your schedule on paper and then really see like, what sleep availability do you have? You know, just kind of making it not a moral or character issue, which is a good door in. And then to get them to stay, you get them with that personal, right? So like, hey, you really value feeling good or performing well at sports, and check this out. Sleep can help you do that. That makes a lot of sense. Tell us more about the teen biology. You kind of teased that, but I think that's a really poignant point that listeners will appreciate.
Yeah, I think that there's so much going on in the teenage brain that we could talk about. There's just so many fascinating developmental, you know, changes that are happening in the teen brain that we could go into. But one is that I think that the main myth about the teen brain is that it's pretty much done developing. I think a lot of people don't appreciate just how much, Julie and I think of it like a second toddlerhood. You know, we know that in the first 3 years of life, the brain is pruning and changing and growing in such an amazing way. And that's so appreciated. And people, you know, would never ever say that a two-year-old doesn't need a lot of sleep, because they know how much their brain is transforming. But as you well know, in teenagehood, around age 10 or 12, this whole new amazing transformation begins again. And it's really integrating the brain. It's making the prefrontal cortex really connected to the rest of the brain. That prefrontal cortex is wiring up and becoming super strong and regulated. And it's such an amazingly, I think teenagers, like, you know, when you watch I have a 14-year-old, you watch him learn something and practice something, and just like the speed of like the expertise that he develops so quickly when he focuses on something that he cares about, like you know, riding a skateboard or doing something like that, he can learn so fast because his brain is in this massive period of sponginess and he can become an expert so quickly. So I think that's something that we don't really appreciate is just how much transformation is going on in the team brain. And what Julie and I were even so fascinated to learn was just how much of it happens while they sleep. So it's, of course, there's things going on during the day while they're awake and functioning, but at night is when all that work is solidified. So much transformation happens during sleep, which is why teenagers actually end up needing more sleep sometimes than they did when they were younger. So teenagers can go from needing, you know, more like 10, 11 hours of sleep to all of a sudden, I mean, a lot of parents of teens have seen this, that they can sleep for 12 hours. That's not laziness. That's because their brains are really, really transforming. So I think that's just a reimagining of what teenagers need. It's seeing them through different eyes, that they're just like when they were 2 years old, they need just as much sleep.
And sometimes we see that parallel emotional regulation of a toddler as well. Like all of a sudden, where you're like, when you were eight, this wouldn't have been a big deal. What's going on? It's the same. Yeah. It's
exactly.
I like to describe it as like your brain's under construction right now. And, you know, to make the invisible visible for listeners, the part of the brain that's most closely associated with executive function, obviously all the parts kind of synthesize and work together, but that it's the prefrontal cortex. That's what Heather and Julie are talking about is heavily under construction during sleep. So again, that kind of speaks to why sleep is one of those three main brain vitamins and so powerful. And you two can clarify too, because I've been an advocate for bumping up school times as well, because you can kind of see when I was teaching middle school, especially, I could see when kids' brains would like fire up and like sort of get online. And it was 9-ish, 10-ish a.m. But we had physically been in the building since like 8:15. And so there were these missed opportunities, sometimes wonky behaviors, sometimes grumpiness, all that kind of teacher delight. And I mean, obviously I knew it wasn't personal, but what I was really empowered with as a perspective was that the melatonin, the chemical in our brains that tells us it's time for sleep, actually has a different schedule in teen brains. Can you two speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. There's what's called a sleep phase delay in adolescence. And what it means is that teenagers literally feel tired about 2 hours later than they did when they were a little bit younger, which of course means, you know, their bodies want to go to sleep about 2 hours later. And of course they want to sleep 2 hours later in the morning. And that's not attitude or, you know, just being resistant to what their parents want them to do. That's actual biology. Just like you said, their melatonin and other sleepiness hormones release later. And in the morning, they continue later, and the cortisol and other alerting hormones aren't released until later. So our teenagers today, in most schools around the country, the school start times do not fit in with this biology at all. They really go against it. So teenagers are often waking up in the middle of their last sort of few hours of sleep when they're heavily in REM sleep, which is also super important for emotional regulation and processing of, you know, perhaps difficult life events, things that the brain needs to kind of sort out and make sense of. And it's much more likely to sort of end up with a positive outlook if that REM sleep can finish. But when they have to get up too early to get to school on time, their sleep is interrupted. They're coming to school in the dark often. They've barely had any sun at all. If some, you know, in some cases in the winter, none. And the sun, the early morning sun, is what sends signals to the brain to say, go, you know, release that cortisol. It's time to send those alerting signals. So teenagers are entering the building like zombies, literally like zombies. And it's not their fault, you know, that they're acting wonky and grumpy. And it makes perfect sense that this is happening. So we are very excited that in California, where Heather lives, they actually have passed a new state law that starts in August, right, Heather? It starts soon.
This school year, yeah.
Yeah, it starts, like, I think in the next few weeks, saying that high schools can start no earlier than 8:30. So it's monumental. It's a monumental shift. And we're so excited to see how it all plays out. New York, where I live, is looking at similar legislation as is New Jersey. So it's really, you know, when I talked about the perfect storm, working on school start times is part of the puzzle. It's not the only thing we need for teens. We need everything to be effective. We need to put all the puzzle pieces into place to help them. But shifting school start times to 8:30 or later is a very big step.
You know, I have a question about a specific impediment that I think teens and parents might be wondering, but I also want to kind of just speak the praises of sleep, because I did this crazy experiment back when I was 35. It took me 35 years to give myself a bedtime, like a legit bedtime. And Heather and Julie, I felt like my IQ went up. It was incredible. I just felt so fresh and able to think more clearly. And it really made me kind of reflect. And I'm so glad that you have done the research and really reflected on what like the main impediments are for teen sleep going into early adulthood. It made me reflect on what was holding me back. And I'm hearing you say, you know, some of it is demands that we can't impact, like school start time or, you know, what colleges are expecting kids to have accomplished or have been part of. But there's also this piece where we do have a little bit more play, and that's the tech and screens. And a lot of my clients feel almost like their brains are stolen by screens in a way that feels a little bit out of control. Like they've got, you know, so many have-tos during the day that their brains are like hungry for all the feel-good chemicals that they get from tech, and it's really hard to peel themselves away. So I would love to hear, like, how do you encourage people to get themselves over that bridge between knowing that they want to go to bed early and doing it when technology is their identified impediment?
Yeah, well, the first thing we say to parents, especially if their teens are a little bit younger, is don't let go of a bedtime and don't let go of those routines and those, you know, park your devices, you know, deadlines too early. If you hold on to them, it's much easier than having to backtrack because you've let go. We find a lot of parents just, you know, it's such a addictive monster that they just throw up their hands and they just give up, you know, and it really, like you said, this technology is taking over our lives. And I think going back to this idea of teens really wanting to be in the know, you know, I think if you talk to them about tech, like you said, like they're stealing our brains, they're, you know, they're stealing your sleep, and these are the ramifications, and having them feel like they have this little bit of an inside take on, you know, big tech sitting there going, oh, this is going just the way we would like it to, you know, and be like, oh no, I don't want them to control my life, you know. And so helping them sort of see it from the other side, and also being very empathic about how hard it is. You know, we all know how hard it is to put our devices down, and, you know, talking about your own use as a parent and your own, you know, changing your habits and modeling well for your kids. You know, I think, you know, those are a couple of things that parents can do. And I think also we find that a lot of parents are afraid to hold a limit around tech, especially, okay, it's, you know, it's 9:30, you know, everyone, including the parents, you know, devices are going to get parked on their chargers. And yeah, of course, if you haven't been doing that, your kids are not going to like it. But after a couple of weeks, if you stick to it and you know, you're consistent, it just becomes a new habit. You know, it's just that they're not used to doing it. And if you replace that time after that in the evening with some pleasurable bedtime routine, you know, components that are enjoyable, and those become the new habit. Maybe, you know, you play a game together. Maybe we even say that families can watch like a 30-minute TV show from a distance together, or, you know, they don't have to be together, but you can have a bedtime routine that's sleep conducive, that doesn't include tech beyond a certain time, and you start to rediscover all of those lovely things like reading a book or listening to a podcast or walking the dog or, you know, finishing your baking project or, you know, there's all kinds of things families can do with that time or teenagers can start to do with that time. So we don't want to just take away, we want to add in as well. So, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so many other ways. A lot of it has to do, like I said earlier, with how we communicate with them, the fact that we really listen carefully to them and to what they care about, and we connect those things to sleep. And we are very empathic about technology and how addicting it is and how hard it is to put it down, rather than just say, you know, you really have to put that down. You know, start by saying, I totally get how hard it is and how you're really engaged in this right now. It's really hard to pull yourself away from it. I totally get that. You know, starting with empathy opens their hearts and minds to the limit. If you just start with the limit, you're much more likely to get pushed back. So, I mean, we have chapter after chapter, you know, on how to talk to your teenagers and then how to get their sort of buy-in, how to help them be self-motivated. And it's a lot harder, you know, than it is to set limits around devices for younger children, but it's absolutely possible. And it will be part of enhancing your overall relationship with them to improve your communication.
Yeah, that sure sounds like it. And, you know, I think some of the fear that my clients have said, it's kind of twofold. The parents are worried that if it's too externally forced upon their teens, that when they go to college, they won't have the skills. So meaning if I'm just physically removing their phone, what are they going to do when they're in college? And so that's a little bit of like some of the fear of change. And so they kind of kick it down the road because our brains procrastinate what's not very clear. So that, and no shade, no judgment. I do it too. Human brains. Am I right? Mm-hmm. But the second thing I hear from parents is that, you know, teen brains are wired to be so socially motivated that there's almost this fear, but like, mom, if I don't have my phone, I'm going to miss out. And so-and-so is going to post and I'm waiting for a text. And I'm using panicky teen voice, not to make fun, but to really like embody, it is a legitimate nearly terror in terms of the social impact. So I know that I just gave you two objections. So pick which one you want to unpack, but how can you speak to those concerns that I hear kind of as a trend?
Well, it's absolutely, I think this is why technology does impact teen sleep so much, because the teen brain is wired for social, is a social brain. So technology just comes in and gives them every opportunity to connect at every moment. And so it really preys on, I wouldn't call it a vulnerability, it's a strength of the teenage brain that they're so social. It's so amazing. It's one of the greatest things about being a teenager. So, but taking that and running with it really heavily impacts it. It's one of the main reasons that teenagers cannot turn their brains off, because their technology is always saying, who just sent a Snapchat? Is there another YouTube video? Oh, let me just watch another, you know? So I think what we describe to teenagers in chapter 6 is creating what we call the sleep bubble. And this concept kind of helps, because when we think about sleep, we usually think of it as starting when you get into bed and ending when you get out of bed, but that's really a misconception. You need a bubble around your sleep on both ends in order for it to do its thing. So the bubble space is that mental, you know, peace of mind and disconnection that comes with doing something that is not highly social and engaging. So not social media for grownups either. I mean, we have the same problem, you know, news updates and alerts, YouTube, things that, you know, just let me check one more time. Let me see that, you know, it keeps your brain thinking there's a puzzle to solve. I got to figure it out. I got to see what people are doing. And your brain starts working hard, and then your adrenaline and your melatonin is suppressed. Your adrenaline goes up and you're basically going into fight or flight mode. So creating a bubble space in the evening is what promotes your natural sleep to take over. So it's especially important for teenagers. We call it wind down time, and we call it the sleep bubble. because they need it even more than we do because their brains are so socially wired. So in the book, we have a lot of options for people to choose from, like Julie said, that are not a bad time, not just taking things away, but things you can do that do protect your bubble, your sleep bubble. And they do not include technology and social media and all those things, but they do include things that people love to do. There's other fun things to do in the world.
What?
So if we just, we have three routines in chapter 6 that are essential to protecting the sleep bubble. It's the wind down routine, the bedtime routine, and the morning routine. And if you can just get those down, your three routines, you have created your sleep bubble. You have protected your brain from, you know, that activation. You've allowed your sleep chemistry to come to the surface. And it's especially important for teenagers because of what you're saying about how social they are.
Yeah. And I love, and I'll kind of kick in with the practical piece of, if you're hearing Heather describe these three routines and you're like, that's a lot, my kid's about to go to college or we're starting the school year, give yourself space and grace. You can do one at a time. And I would, you know, prioritizing is an executive function. So how about you pick the one that, like, it's kind of the hottest point, the like biggest pain point, master that. And then it's just adding in layers. That's all it is.
That's a great idea.
Well, thanks. You can include me in your next book. I love that. And I love the social piece and the just, you know, recognizing and celebrating teen biology. There's no shame. They're just, they have very different brains. And I want to offer too that in most cases, when we're saying adolescent, when we're saying teen brain, it doesn't actually graduate out when you turn 20, because the numbers stop saying teen. Really, adolescents can span to about, what's your functional? Mine's functional 25?
25, yeah.
Okay. So everybody, that includes college. That includes, like, your brain is under construction all the way through. So that means that these healthy sleep habits are incredibly important and really valuable and worth the little bit of discomfort and pushback with your kid until it becomes a routine. You can do it because it's so important going forward. And with that, you know, how can we make it really concrete for parents to break down, or how do I say this? Kind of like ordinate the process for passing responsibility for sleep routines. Because initially, you know, when our kids are babies, obviously we're doing it for them. And then when they're kids, we're doing it with them. Eventually we pass that gradual release of responsibility and our kids are mostly owning it with maybe a few prompts from us. What does that look like functionally in, like, really healthy models that you've seen?
Yeah, we have a little concept in the book that's called the parent fade. And it's the visual is a staircase. So as your teen starts, so you may have a limit around, you know, devices or curfews or bedtimes or that kind of thing. And you know, as your teen starts to show more responsibility, then you give them more freedom. You don't monitor and check in and tell them what to do. So they sort of climb this staircase, which is very developmentally appropriate, so that by the time, like to your earlier point, by the time they go off to college, they're not just so hungry for freedom. We want to dole out freedom as they show responsibility. So it's a bit of a staircase climb toward freedom, that they sort of earn that freedom by showing responsibility. So I think it's hard as a parent to let go of controlling and telling your kid what to do. You know, I remember when my son was in high school, he, you know, there was this feeling that everything I said, he already knew. He didn't need me to say most of the things I said to him. So there's a better way sometimes to say, you know, even if it's just as simple as saying, I know you already know this, but blah, 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 you know, just really honoring the fact that they really don't want to be treated like a child anymore. So it's really an important part of the journey. I agree with you.
Yeah. And, you know, I can add on just like a logistical piece and kind of, I empower parents to coach their kids sometimes. And what I've really found powerful is the language around, you shared that this X was your goal. So in this case, it would be, you shared that getting 7 hours of sleep this week is your goal. You know, I mean, well, not total, every night. That's what I meant. And I know obviously that's not enough, but that could be kind of a soft landing as we progress towards the ideal. So you shared that getting enough sleep was your goal. What's your plan to, or how do you plan to achieve that? Because I think those types of questions, like you're saying, honor their independence and sort of skip the step that we're even assuming that it's a choice and just speak right to their agency. Like, I know you're going to do this. You are going to be successful at this goal. Tell me what it's going to look like. And I've got a lot of bang for my buck out of that type of questioning, because it almost tricks their brains to like bypass the rejection component and say like, oh yeah, you believe me. Okay. Well, let me think about my goal or my plan, you know?
Talk about what it is about sleep that your teen thinks is the most relevant to them, because that's also part of it, is that we may have our concept of why sleep is so important, but sleep really, like, all roads lead to sleep. So whether it's, you know, getting sick less often, having your skin look better, getting better at jump, like higher jumping in basketball, less injury, you know, in lacrosse, better lap times. And I'm swimming, I'm naming all sports things, but it's not just sports. It's like memorizing your lines if you're in a musical, your mental health. You know, kids who sleep at least 8 hours a night have about half the incidence of depressive symptoms. So as parents, let's step back for a second and think about how important mental health is. And we're all trying to figure out how to support teenagers because we know they're suffering with a lot of depression and anxiety. Sleeping at least 8 hours a night is the number one first step to that, because we know that it lowers by literally half their experience of mental health issues. So thinking about which of those things are important to your teen, and then, like you said, stepping into the positive and saying, okay, well, let me support you in your goal of getting there. And what does it look like, and what habits? That's why we have in our book, we have a teen cheat sheet that is really just speaking directly to teenagers and saying, okay, your parents aren't, you know, your parents might've given you this part of the book. Here we are, we talk directly to teenagers, and we really make it very short and powerful so they can pick the habits that they want to change. So I think there's a lot of scary information about sleep out there, but I think it's more helpful for teenagers to flip it to the positive. Like, what do you want more of? Sleep will help you get that, because it will.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And just kind of keeping in mind that teens need to be sold. They need to have that personal buy-in, because otherwise, you know, they're developmentally, they're striving for independence. That's what they are programmed to do. So we can give them that independence through sort of the menu of options, like you were talking about, developing their sleep bubble or having them pick which benefit they're really going to like concentrate on and keep focus on. Yeah, that's really powerful. So you two are super successful women. You've written 2 books. You're on podcasts. You're doing all the things. You're helping people. And I imagine you practice what you preach. And let's be real, human brains sometimes don't. So I imagine there are moments where you just burn the candle from both ends, and then you feel, you've got feelings about that, I'm sure. What are your tried and true, like really helpful tools that you use to protect your sleep?
Well, I don't think mine are super fancy. They're pretty basic in that I really do go to bed at the same time every night. I work really hard all day long, but around dinner time, I really stop working and, you know, make dinner, eat dinner, maybe watch a little TV, but I'm not working and writing and doing crazy work stuff in the evening. It's just not, I'm a morning lark, so it's just not my thing. So I'm in wind down mode really for quite a few hours before I go to bed. And if my bedtime gets moved later, it's not because I'm sort of like breaking my rules. It's because something else in my life, maybe I go to a performance, or I have somebody visiting, or I'm traveling, or my sister who's a night owl, you know, keeps me up or something like that. So I'm really the quintessential, like, you know, believer that And it, you know, we didn't say this yet today, but some of the research shows that regularity is just as important as duration when it comes to sleep. So going to bed at the same time every night, and I have to go to bed early enough because I'm an early riser. If I don't go to bed early enough, I won't get enough sleep. So that's another example of something that I do. And Heather and I both, we're both about dimming the lights and really creating that sort of, that sun is setting pretty dramatically in the evening. And that's a big help. And the other thing is the stress-free zone. That's part of the wind down routine, in addition to parking devices and clearing, you know, screens out of the way, is not engaging in stressful conversations. And my family knows this about me. They'll just say like, oh, I know you don't want to talk about this right now. We'll talk about it like tomorrow at 4 or something. I'm like, okay, because I get just the tiniest bit of anxiety makes it hard for me to fall asleep. So
yeah, Julie and I are both very diligent about our sleep bubbles. So I have, you know, I have kids and a tween and a teen, and I go around and turn the lights down very inconspicuously, so no one really is paying that much attention. But I'm going around and like turning off this lamp and then this overhead light. And at a certain time, I'm very diligent about winding the house down with lowering the lights. And then we have a time for cutoff of personal devices. And then we come together and watch a movie or whatever TV show we're watching. And then we have a bedtime routine. So for me, it's really my wind down time and my protecting my sleep bubble that are the most important things. And then Julie mentioned early on the morning sun. It's also something that I very diligently force my kids to do. I make them go outside and eat breakfast outside if it's the weekend. We wake up within 1 to 2 hours of our regular weekday wake up time on the weekends. So no one's sleeping in until noon, because we know that that leads to social jet lag. So the morning routine for me is also really powerful, because it sets the stage for your internal clock to know when to go to bed at night. So regulating and making your brain clock happy by going outside and being exposed to the sun for even 5 minutes is extremely important. So everyone in my family is like, oh God, oh, here we go again, like eating my oatmeal out on the back porch. Doesn't matter if it's cloudy, doesn't matter if it's cold, the sun is extremely powerful.
Wow. You mentioned something, social jet lag. What's that?
It's the experience of our brains trying to keep a time, which is the internal time that they'd like to keep, but then being forced into something that's out of sync with that in real life. So the main example is teenagers who have a natural delay in their biological clock. They would like to go to bed later and wake up later, but we force them to wake up early. It's what you were talking about with the fogginess and the wacky behavior, the, you know, wonky behavior in the morning. That's social jet lag, because their brains would not like to be awake at that time. So their brain clock is operating out of sync with life. So they would prefer to take a calculus exam at 10:30, not at 8 o'clock in the morning. But we make them take a calculus exam at 8:30 and then, you know, wonder why they're falling asleep on their desks. So they're being asked to do things at the wrong time. And yeah, it feels like social jet lag, feels like real jet lag, except you haven't traveled.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's kind of a social construct, like we've created the problem.
Yeah. And then when they shift their sleep, you know, from that already social jet lag weekday existence, when they shift dramatically on the weekend, that just creates more social jet lag. So now they're not only out of sync with their weekday schedule, but they're just completely out of sync. Their schedule is so far off. So it seems like a good idea to catch up on sleep, but at the end of the day, it's not only very stressful for the body, but it makes falling asleep on Sunday night to get enough sleep for school on Monday morning really difficult.
And how, right? I think a lot of people with jobs appreciate that too, because there's that mix of anxiety for the next day paired with you're not as exhausted because you slept in and a rough start. Yeah. Well, I am deeply appreciative of this conversation. I love learning from amazing experts like the two of you. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. This was really fun.
Yeah, it was really our pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, you can grab Heather and Julie's Generation Sleepless any store you can get books from, or ask your library to carry it. That's a great way to, you know, use your interest to help other parents learn too. Because if you request it from the library, it goes into rotation and helps even more people. Thank you both so, so much.
Thank you for listening to the Executive Function Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please head over to sarahcasti.com, where you'll find more resources and chances to connect with others. And please remember to like and review the show wherever you listen to this podcast. We're eager to transform the lives of even more families.